Hello, hello, hello. We are dancing in the discomfort zone today. My name is Anne Bonnie. Thank you for dancing with me. And, you know, sometimes doing this podcast, I mean, the thing I love, and I've said this over and over and over, the thing I love about this podcast is basically I get to interview whoever I want. And in this case, this is Jerry Mikulski, is a brain. He, and we talk about his brain, both the internal one and the external one. You'll figure out what that means in just a little bit. But he's one of those super smart people who I could just sit with my hands on my fists and listen to for hours because he thinks through things in a much, much deeper way. And the cool thing is he now has focused his business and his thoughts and his the work that he's doing on trust. And I think, and on mistrust and on systems of mistrust. And in this episode, we talk a lot about trust, how to build it, where it comes from, how to lose it, how it's being used, both trust and mistrust. So, you know, as we talk about dancing in the discomfort zone and things that make us uncomfortable, you know, if you think a few layers deeper, a lot of times trust and mistrust come into what makes these things so challenging. So, enjoy this episode with the brilliant Jerry Mikulski. Enjoy. We are dancing in the discomfort zone today with Jerry Mikulski. Jerry, how are you today?
I am doing fabulously. Really happy to be here with you.
It's great to have you here. And you're zooming in from beautiful and fascinating Portland, Oregon.
Portland is great. Oregon has a very interesting and checkered history, but it's a lovely place to live.
Yeah, I love it. I'm speaking at a conference there in May. So I look forward
Excellent.
To coming out. I was in Eugene for the first time recently and I loved it.
It's beautiful.
It. Yeah. So you specialize in trust and mistrust, and you're one of those people that, you know, thinks about things and gets deep into things. So I was really excited to welcome you onto the show because I think trust or the lack thereof is a really important piece of dancing in the discomfort zone and being able to trust some things and understanding what do I not trust. So tell me a little bit about what you do and how you got there. Let's start there.
Thanks. So my journey to trust starts with the word consumer. And I realized somewhere in the mid 90s, I can actually sort of pinpoint some of the incidents that led to the light bulb lighting up in my head. And they have a lot to do with discomfort. So I had a couple briefings in like 94. I was a tech industry trends analyst. So my job was not how many boxes did so-and-so sell, you know, Dell sell, but rather, should we be using neural networks technology? And I've just recently uncovered and scanned a report I wrote in 1988, titled Neural Networks: Prospects for Commercial Use. So in 94, I have a briefing from women.com, and I knew Ellen Pack, the founder of women.com. She was a young entrepreneur and she was great. And she had hired in a new CEO. So I had a lunch meeting next to our offices in Manhattan with Marlene McDaniel, the new CEO of women.com. And I was really excited because early internet, the internet is just this little tiny bubbling thing, 94. Women.com should be important. Glass ceiling, misogyny, like there's an endless number of interesting issues to talk about. And we get into the interview and a couple sentences in, she tells me a completely truthful statement that breaks my heart. She says, my job is to sell women to advertisers. And I don't remember what we talked about the rest of the lunch. I don't remember the rest of the lunch. I went into some little limbo zone and I felt betrayed. And I felt like here was an opportunity to do some serious progress on important issues, and we were going to sell women to advertisers. And that was when I started realizing, well, there are lots of other incidents along the way, that the advertising business model is actually involves several betrayals of trust. And we take it for granted. We've completely normalized it. The platforms that are some of the most valuable companies on the planet, Facebook and Google most notably, base their revenues almost entirely on the ad model. Right? On our data, right? And selling off our data and selling off our attention and whatever else. And so that was one of the entrances. Another big entrance was roughly around the same time, I had lunch with a retired New York high school teacher named John Taylor Gatto, G-A-T-T-O. And he is a big fan of unschooling. He wrote an essay that my friend Doc Searle sent me years ago called The Six Lessons School Teacher. And Gatto says, nominally, I'm your high school English teacher, but let me tell you what I'm really teaching you. I'm teaching your kids that in class, I am God. What I say goes. that you are not allowed to fidget or be disruptive in any way. I will punish you. I'm teaching you to be a little gear in the big metronome, the big gear mechanism that runs this whole place. I'm teaching you compliance, obedience, and dependence, and a bunch of other. And he started talking about what some other educator critics have talked about, also called the hidden curriculum of schooling, of which some of the things I just named are elements. And if that doesn't make you uncomfortable, I don't know what will, because I went through compulsory education and I turned out, I think, pretty okay. But once I start reflecting, I'm the most curious person I know. And my curiosity somehow survived that process. I'm sort of like fighting that rebellious streak, because I still like, I'd rather be curious than do anything else. And so I realized that we've been breaking trust. Now, let me go back to the Marlene incident. So I talked with my boss at the time and I said, you know, that this word consumer, and Marlene had said, you know, we talked about consumer marketing and all that. This word consumer really bothers me. And my boss was like, you know, it's just a term of art in the ad business. Don't worry about it. And my little inner voice said, no. This is actually a really important part of the problem. And I paid attention to that discomfort, which fed me for 30 years. And then the word consumer took me to the word trust over 15 years. I did not know at the beginning that I was going to land on trust and be, you know, care about trust and make that sort of a piece of the center of what I do. It took a long time to get there. And in the meantime, in 2010, I invented what I now would call a mastermind group. It was called the Relationship Economy Expedition, or REX. And at this point, Rex is just an alumni group. We have a call every month just to sort of kick over what's going on in the world. But the relationship economy was my counterpoint to the attention economy and the experience economy, two very well-known tropes, neither of which I like at all. And I was trying to say, we're going to rediscover trust and relationships and all those kinds of things. And look at all these interesting movements out there trying to fix the world. And in the meantime, a whole lot of weird things have happened, and there's been backlash, and there's this whipsawing out in the political sphere. So there's plenty to talk about there. Mm. But I'm discovering that there are people in the political sphere in particular who have as their intentional strategy, and it's a legit strategy, it's just not a nice strategy, to undermine trust, to break discourse, to make it so that we can't actually talk to each other and believe what the other says, undermine science, undermine journalism. And by the way, journalism has been doing a great job of destroying its own credibility. So, hey, undermine trust in one another, undermine trust in elections and the electoral process. And once you've broken all those things, kind of all bets are off. It could be a free for all. And I think that's what they're betting on. And again, I pay a lot of attention to strategies around this, and that's a very legitimate strategy. It's just a really underhanded kind of, it's worse than Dr. Evil, because Dr. Evil never succeeds in killing Austin Powers.
Well, but, and I feel like the part of the problem with that kind of strategy is it is a short-term strategy. And so yes, many of these strategies are really short-term and kind of all fall apart at the end.
Both of the things you just said, short-term and fall apart, you might take more literally than you think, because one of the things that these people are doing is trying to accelerate our decline and the breaking of current systems. And one reason, for example, why I think a lot of people voted for Trump legitimately was they think Trump is a fire ship that they're pushing into the enemy fleet, which is the overwhelming bureaucratic administrative, you know, thing, beast, and they want it to break.
Yep.
And if he happens to be an ugly individual and make money along the way, that's the price you pay for actually breaking the system. And who gets to reinvent the system? What is the new system we're going to have? And ironically, one of my big questions in the back of my head, because I've got a bunch of them, is what is the next system look like?
Yeah.
At multiple levels, right? And so what does our next social system look like? Was 2006 peak democracy, because we have all these autocracies and illegitimate democracies rising around the world. Ours sort of on its way, depending who wins the next election. So all of that.
Well, and that's the scary thing. And because I have heard people who voted for Trump who say, I just want something different, which, bingo, you know, you can't argue with that, because this, you know, the problem with that I see, and I don't want to go down this rabbit hole too much, but those people who are using this not good, you know, morally happy strategy full of trust and loveliness and dancing and sparkles are the ones that are going to get to create that new system, which is the scary part, you know,
or at least that's what they hope.
Well, yeah, well, exactly. Oh, woo! So go back though, because I want to talk about this. The thing that made me uncomfortable was, as you talked about the hidden curriculum of education, was the guy you were, the teacher you were talking to, saying, this is what it actually is, and I don't like that? Or was he on board with that hidden curriculum?
He was unmasking the hidden curriculum and saying, hey, this is not a good thing. And he was winning all kinds of teaching awards. So then they started sending observers into his classroom and all that, which broke his ability to be a good teacher, because the way he was being a good teacher is by breaking some of the rules. Like, you're never allowed to leave a child alone. And he would send kids to an empty classroom to go work on a, you know, on an essay. He would send kids into the neighborhood to sell ads in New York, to sell ads for the newspaper he wanted them to write at the quality of the New York Times, et cetera, et cetera. So he was trusting the kids to sort things out, and he was holding them to a pretty high standard. And that didn't work under scrutiny. So then he wrote an essay later that said, you know, I'm out. I'm resigning as a teacher. You've made it impossible for me to be a teacher. And then he went full time to being a major social critic. I recommend his book, The Underground History of American Education, by the way. He also recommended my first good history book. Before that, I didn't know how to read history. And he recommended Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley, who is a foreign affairs expert and a finance expert. And it's sort of obscure. It's about the history of the world financial system from 1900 to 1966 when the book is published. And it tells you, like, who was doing what to whom behind the scenes during the Great Depression, during the rise of banking and the financialization of the world, all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. So this is what history could be like.
Mm.
Right. And then one thing I want to say is, as you work into this discomfort zone of how things happened, how the sausage got made, you can easily walk the crater lip of conspiracy theories and a whole bunch of other crap that's actually really dangerous. And that is bait is hanging out there to drag you in, because if you're uncomfortable about vaccines or whatever, hey, QAnon has like an answer for that. And part of what I'm trying to study is, how do we come back into a world based on trust in a world that's full of all those kinds of things, where communicating, you and I are sitting here on video recording audio at a marginal cost of zippity-doo-dah, right? And we have the magic superconductivity of information across the world, but we don't have a way to put dye marker on the bad stuff, so that when it shows up somewhere, they go, oh, I should maybe not pay attention to this thing. It's somebody trying to mess with my mind.
Yeah. Well, so how do we wade through and know what to trust, know what not to trust? I mean, because that's ultimately the dance, right? When we trust, we have to kind of let go of control and believe that somebody has the agenda that fits mine. And you know, how, Jerry, how?
So a couple ways I can recommend. Luckily, there's some remedies here. The first one is really old school. You and I met at a face-to-face event, and we spent a couple of days together in a place, and we bonded because we know each other, and I trust you implicitly. And I'm sure we disagree on stuff, and I would be excited to discover what those things are. And I bet if we started talking about the things that we disagree about, it would be a really fun conversation too. Mm-hmm. But at the other end of things, everybody can't meet everybody, but the people meeting thing actually scales really well. Because we all have friends, and those friends connect. And if you look at small world group theory, it only takes one person who connects a couple groups to make the groups have connection, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if we go to the larger scale, I came up with a thing that's not quite a methodology yet, called design from trust. And if you've ever used the Wikipedia, you've experienced design from trust, because the Wikipedia is designed from trust, although those are not words that any Wikipedian would use, because I haven't published the book yet and nobody knows about the concept like they know about the attention economy. But design from trust means starting with an assumption of good intent. So if you go to Wikipedia, one of their rules is the similar rule to what open source software says, which is assume good intent. When you get an email that looks dangerous or whatever else, assume the person means well, but just didn't communicate well, whatever else it might be. And that doesn't mean that there aren't bad actors. And you need to figure out how to deal with bad actors, but you have to start with an assumption of good intent. We're not doing that these days at all. The whole realm of political discourse is pretty poisoned. We also have sort of vigilante culture in social media. We've not done a good job of doing this. And so design from trust is a framework within which we might rethink and redesign a whole bunch of institutions from a basis of assuming that most people are trying to help. Mm-hmm. And I found dozens of examples of systems and services and markets that I would say are designed from trust. Again, mm-hmm. they wouldn't use that language, but the common thread is that they do things, you know, Uber is not the best actor in the world. I think they're a crappy company, but the sharing economy, the idea that you're going to climb into somebody else's car and let them drive you somewhere.
It's everything your mom taught you not to do as a little bing, kid, bing, right? Bing.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. All the alarms should be going off, but there's certainly safety mechanisms and there's certainly bad things that happen on Ubers because it's gotten so big. But in general, ride sharing and resource sharing, like, you know, home sharing, all that kind of stuff, didn't look like a business to any entrepreneur before these companies launched. And all of a sudden, bing, they're, so that sector is designed from trust. Microfinance, giving people who have no collateral, who have nothing you could take, nothing of value you could take, giving them small loans. It turns out they repay better than, I was just reading an article about a woman who is a philanthropist and started a bunch of companies and like has no idea how to manage money. And her loans are all gone and done. And she's just had a terrible financial background. I'm like, don't want to lend her money, banks. Lend money to the people who actually work hard and want to repay you. Right? So that's designed from trust, is microfinance. And Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2006, I think, for coming up with the idea of giving 21 Pakistani women the equivalent of $50 or $25. So for me, that's the larger scale remedy. That the small bore, small scale, personal, old school remedy is us doing what we're doing, getting to know each other in person, and Zoom ain't bad. You know, the distance is okay as long as we get to have conversations that can wander as if we get to know each other some.
Yeah. And it reminds me of a quote from Michelle Obama that I really love. That is, it's harder to hate up close.
Yes. I love that too.
When we're talking and I see you and you're fun and you smile and you send your wife cards and like, it's this, you're a lovely human. So when we disagree on politics or something like that, like you said, we can have a discourse where that basis of trust and respect is there.
Exactly. And Congress has had its ups and downs. I'm sorry to keep going back to politics, but it's so much in the air right now. We're mid-campaign for the 2024 election cycle, et cetera. There used to be comity. There was always pressure politics and always a bunch of dark stuff happening. But they used to try to sort of agree and figure things out in Congress. Not always. If you read about the run-up to the Civil War, it was worse. I mean, Charles Sumner was almost beaten to death on the floor of Congress with another guy with a cane, I'm forgetting his name, a South Carolinian, who didn't like his speech about abolition, right? So things got extremely hairy, and then a bunch of states just up and left.
Yeah.
And then we lost a whole bunch of, you know, Americans in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So trust is this wonderful, complicated, multi-layer, thorny, delicate, fragile issue that we don't pay enough attention to. It's a word kind of maybe like democracy, where we use the word, but we don't think about what it means. Like, yeah, democracy, but what do you really mean by democracy? Which flavor? There's lots of flavors of democracy.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. The word has been defined externally.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as we think about dancing in the discomfort zone specifically, you've said that discomfort is an important indicator to help guide you. What do you mean by that?
So when I had that conversation with Marlene McDaniel and I realized that she'd broken my heart, that's about when I realized that I didn't like the word consumer. So I mentioned that to my boss. She said, don't worry about it. That was my discomfort at the time. And the most valuable thing I've done in the last 30 years is pay attention to that itch. That itch gave me my point of view, right? And a lot of people are looking for purpose, meaning, mission, point of view. Those kinds of things are really pretty important for people. And I think a lot of that comes out of what bothers you. And weirdly, like 5-year-olds are just really good at this. They're just gifted. They know what's wrong. They really know what's wrong. And if we haven't stamped out their sense of agency and their sense of responsibility or interdependence or whatever, they'll even act on it. Our niece was on TV in Denver when she was 7 many years ago, because she saw homeless people and was like, this isn't right. So she started making bags of food to give them. and going on and a reporter found out about it and got her on the air. And I'm like, yeah, because kids know what's broken. And as adults, we've internalized and normalized so many things that aren't quite right, that part of the magic of finding your way through life is figuring out which of those is really wrong that you might be able to right in some way, maybe even beyond your lifetime. Maybe it's too big a bite because it won't get solved in your lifetime, but maybe if you worked on it, you would be happy.
Well, and I think that too big a bite is a common thing that stops people from trying to do anything. And this is a concept I've been playing with since 2020, which is shrinking the bubble. It's like, it doesn't have to solve the whole thing. Just do a little something, you know? And that little bit, it's the whole starfish story, right? I made a difference for that one.
Exactly.
And if we all did that, well, hello, we'd be good.
I was going to bring up the old joke about how do you eat an elephant? And the answer is one bite at a time.
Yeah. Just take a little bite.
And we're not alone in this. One of the cool things, one of the other topics I care a lot about is just collaboration, cooperation. In particular, how do we use connectivity to cooperate and collaborate more and better? And so you don't need to be alone on this quest. And part of what I care about is how do we marshal what we know so that we can fix these problems together and so that other people can bump into what we figured out and improve it and use it.
Yeah.
So this idea of collective memory, collaborative sense making, hive mind, it has a bunch of different names, right?
Where jerrysbrain.com comes in?
It is, exactly.
So by the way, audience, real quick, Jerry has a website called jerrysbrain.com. Now, I could make an andsbrain.com, but nobody wants to go in there.
Oh, come on.
Well, tell me a little bit about this.
So I used to be a tech industry trends analyst. In 97, December of 97, because I found the brochure they sent me, I had my first meeting with a little company called The Brain. It had a different name back then, but it's basically the product is called The Brain, and now the company is called The Brain. And the briefing happens, the inventor opens his laptop, shows me this little mind map on a blue background, and my wet brain on board brain, my brain classic, because now I have to rename it backwards.
Actual brain.
Exactly, my actual in-place brain, okay?
Yeah.
Said, hey, that's how I think. And so I wrote about the software. I invited them to our conference. I started using the software. And the brain file that I fed some things this morning, from articles from my email flow, for example, is the same data file that I started in January of 98. So I've been feeding a single mind map for 26 years. Last December was 26 years. It works fine. There's no dark forest corner of it. And I've had this memory that's reliable that I can keep feeding things into, which means I'm having a really weird and unusual experience than most humans on the planet, because the rest of us are, I'm also drowning in the information torrent.
Mm-hmm.
There is just too much coming at us all the time. It's one of my daily problems. It's just like making my way through all the rush of incoming, interesting info. But when I look at something interesting, I quickly add it where it belongs into my brain file. So it builds the arguments as evidence. And I try not to put crap in there because I don't want to litter the space. Nobody's rewarding me for fresh info in my brain. My brain is my own little radar of what I see in the world and what I want to remember. That's all it is. And because that's all it is, it's really useful. So I got to thinking, what would it look like if more of us did this and externalized our memories? My wet brain happens to love this little mind mappy thing. Other people like outlines with backlinks. Other people like concept maps that have systems theory kind of, there's a whole bunch of different, the umbrella term is called tools for thinking. And I don't think everybody needs to do that work, but I think there's a lot of people passionate about it. And just like with Wikipedia, there's a couple thousand people who built the Wikipedia. And guess what? It's consistently among the 10 top visited websites on the planet. It's the only one that doesn't leave cookies on your machine. Thank you so much. And so I think that something like that could happen also for a layer above Wikipedia, for what we think, what we believe, so that you and I could contrast our belief systems and figure out where we disagree a little bit, and maybe then find evidence, set up an experiment, ask an expert, bring them on your podcast, whatever else it might be, but make progress instead of having the same conversations over and over and over again, which is what happens when you're drowning in the information flood and you have no place to pin things down a little bit.
Right. And when you've marked them, then you can go back to them, connect them. And yeah, and again, going back to this trust, and this kind of moves into self-trust, right? Where I can trust that the information's there so I can go get it, I can link it, I can do the things I need.
Bingo. And also, my brain is kind of secure through obscurity. Not that many people know it exists. I don't have a lot of traffic. But what I put in my brain, everything I put in my brain is public by default because I publish my brain openly. If you go to jerrysbrain.com, you can browse it, etc. I discovered that very few people are public by default. Most people are public only when they post a blog post or a TikTok or whatever else it might be, right? And I want us, more of us, working with the garage door open. Mm. And it involves a certain amount of vulnerability because I'm saying, this is the stuff I believe. There's a thought in my brain. Every note is called a thought. There's a thought called my beliefs. And under it is a big collection of things I think to be true, right? And I'm happy to change these over time. I'm completely open to the discussion, the debate, whatever, and would look forward to that. But I'm looking for more playmates or people who want to enter that arena and do some of that thinking in more full public view.
Yeah. Well, and the challenge these days, as we talked about earlier, is the alternative agendas that may not be as morally straight.
So yes. And in my brain, I went and listened to a video, an interview with Steve Bannon. And I think I do not like Steve Bannon. I think he's really smart. And I wrote down from that interview, in good faith, I took notes and I wrote down his assertions. And those are thoughts in my brain, the things he said. And I'll say that 50, 60% of those assertions, I completely agree with. It's the other ones that are problematic. And so I wish people like Steve Bannon would undertake a project sort of like this with whatever tool they like. And I want to go in and talk with them through the medium with what we're doing right now, which is the human part of it. Mm-hmm. And I don't really want AIs to jump in and take that over. I want us to engage in that and see where that goes. And I know that there are people who are really good at disinformation, at flooding the zone with bullshit, which is a well-known strategy. There's a whole bunch of ways that you can destroy discourse. In fact, I think I coined the term denial of discourse attacks, because on the web, there are denial of service attacks where somebody floods a web server with too many requests for websites. You create a bot army. You get millions of computers around the world to send the same message to the same server, and you basically take it offline. That's a denial of service attack on the web. A denial of discourse attack is when I make it impossible to hear or understand a sincere conversation that's trying to happen.
Mm. Wow.
People want sincerity. I think people want to trust each other. People want to connect.
Yeah,
of course. People want community. They want to know they belong. Belonging is hugely important. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why people stand firmly by nonsense narratives of what's going on in the world is that ostracism, removal from your tribe, short of execution, is the worst punishment humans can give other humans.
Yeah.
Ostracism, really bad, right? So in order to stay in your tribe, and if you live in a place that's like Trump country and everybody's got a banner on their lawn and a flag on their truck, like, and at church and wherever else, that's all anybody thinks and talks. It's hard, A, to believe that anybody else believes something different. But B, it's really hard to run differently, to go against the flow.
Right.
It's really, really hard.
Well, especially since you don't trust that the agenda is we're both on the same team, the same Bingo. Human team, and let's move together. Yeah,
precisely.
Yeah. I mean, I could talk to you about this for hours. And so well, when I come to Portland, we'll have to get together.
Please.
But do you have any ideas, I mean, on solution? If you got elected and you got to elected, you know, king of the universe, and you get to redesign some of these things, obviously this human connection piece is massive. But do you have any other solutions that you're thinking would be great?
Actually, strangely, yes, because I've got this long-term memory, right? This external brain. So not only would I propose design from trust, I would have everybody redesign their industry, their services from a basis of trust. And that would be a much longer call to explain what that means. And as I said, it's not a fully fleshed out methodology, partly because it involves trust. Mm-hmm. And the conversation on trust has to involve interacting with other people as your mirror, because some of the things that you're doing that are not trustworthy, you have normalized and think are perfectly fine. And somebody needs to say, well, let me just tell you what, how this feels or what it does or what the dynamics are and what the alternatives are. Because another part of change is that if you don't have, if you don't see a clear path across the stormy river, you're never going to try to cross that stormy river, right? And you actually have to see people on the other shore who have safely crossed.
Survived, yeah.
Then you're willing to sort of do change. So there's a bunch of that, you know, I would say designed from trust. And then I think that we, there's a whole bunch of ways that we can actually change the world together by coming together and doing this at scale in different ways. Well, I had a different thought I wanted to bring in, but I've lost it anyway.
Okay. But yeah, and I love this. And again, it can go so far and be, you know, but again, going back to that, shrink the bubble. I always think that when I'm like, the world is terrible, everything's bad. And I'm like, all right, cool. What can you do? Shrink it. Be nice to the person outside that's walking by. Just say hi to them. You know, I mean, it's the little things that make people realize not everybody's bad and not everything's bad.
And some things are very small and easy, like just smiles, you know, smiles are gifts.
Yeah.
And just, I don't know when or why, but I had this notion long ago that most every interaction, I can probably at least offer a smile and maybe make the other person smile. So if I'm composing an email, if I'm interacting with somebody at the grocery store, whatever, that comes into it for me. It's and a piece of every small interaction.
Exactly. And as Dolly Parton said in The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, if you see somebody without a smile, give them yours.
Exactly. I did not realize that came from Best Little Whorehouse.
Oh, such a good movie.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to have to make that connection. I'm going to have to make that connection in my brain. And I just remembered the other thing I was going to say, which is I have two nexuses, two focal areas in my brain that are relevant here. One of them is rethinking. And I have rethinking politics, rethinking education, rethinking finance, rethinking everything, where I've collected up stories and examples of what this might be. And then I have another area, which is kind of like a policy platform. And if somebody made me emperor tomorrow and assumed I was a benevolent emperor, it contains links. It's a little messy, but it's all there. And given a little more time, I'd probably clean it up some. But there's the kinds of things that I would go institute and implement. And at this moment, I've got a couple calls running, a short sequence of four calls about governance. And why is governance so broken is not the question we're trying to answer, because there's lots of good critiques about what's broken. We're trying to figure out what works in governance at all scales. So when a hockey team tries to figure out what are our rules for accepting a new member or whatever, that's the governance at a very tiny, tiny personal scale. And then all the way up to how do we manage elections and should there be an electoral college and what about that United Nations thing and so forth? That's all governance, right? So I'm trying to collect up wisdom about governance to make some resources available for others to go build on.
Wow. I love it. And I literally just put rethinking into your brain because I'm in your brain right now. And there are 672 different results of all the different things. How fascinating.
I love
that. How cool is
this? This is what happens when you feed a memory for 26 years, for a quarter century. Now, I don't want to dissuade people because it's useful after, you know, a memory is useful after 6 months. It just so happens that I've put so many things in that now when I search my brain for something new to put in and I realize I don't have it, I'm kind of shocked because it's like I've covered, you know, the elements, actors in their movies, cocktail recipes, all the stuff like that, breeds of dog and all that are in there. As is like animal breeding is this incredible like hubris of humans to change the shape. And, you know, we've done it in particular, like bulldogs can barely breathe because you used to throw them into pits against bulls. They're called bulldogs because they used to hang onto the ears of bulls and get flung around for people's entertainment. What?
Yeah.
Right. You know, bull baiting is a thing. The turnspit dog is called a turnspit because it's a little dog that runs a lot. And they used to put it into a little wheel that was next to your fireplace. You would put the spit of the food in the fire, the rod would come outside to the little wheel that the dog was in, and then you would throw a hot coal under the dog so it would run. And it would turn your food. The breed is called a turnspit. Yeah. Dachshunds have short legs because they were bred to jump into warrens and chase like rats and small critters.
Yeah.
Stuff like that is all. And opinions I hold about things and big questions that I love to answer and all that kind of stuff. And it accrues because the brain's quirky display lets you see just enough to stretch your brain, but not too much to explode it at one time.
And you've got it all in one easy to search place. I love this. Well, jerrysbrain.com is that website. Where else can people find you and more about what you do?
So I've got jerrymikulski.com, jerrysbrain.com, designfromtrust.com, which has a little bit on it, not a lot, but my TEDx talk is there and a couple of essays about what is this thing. And right now I'm writing a neo book, sort of a deconstructed book about design from trust. So more on that coming at some point soon. And then just for fun, there's not much on it, but I own thebigfungus.org.
Because why wouldn't you?
Because the thing I was describing earlier about above Wikipedia, kind of conceptually, the space where we can share opinions and beliefs and narratives, that space doesn't really have a name. We don't know what to call it. And when I try to describe it to people, I have to sort of work my way into it and paint the vision a little bit like impressionistically with words. So just because I think that fun projects that are a little tongue in cheek are good, and also because mycelium and mushroom is such a good metaphor for everything.
Yeah.
So I bought thebigfungus.com.org. And my hope is that my brain data file, when I die, becomes an inoculation into the big fungus that all of us are contributing to and living off of the same way that we're living off of Wikipedia right now. Because it's one of the top 10 most visited websites. That means people are actually using this collective encyclopedia. Awesome. Absolutely love that.
And trusting the data.
But you can't tell your story with Wikipedia. I use Wikipedia links all the time. You'll find Wikipedia links littered throughout my brain data. But I want to tell those stories and say, I posted a couple of videos about why the global financial crisis happened. And my thesis was, it's called SNP. I think what happened was we snipped a whole bunch of long-term relationships that held the financial system in place and made it more secure. And that enabled the GFC to happen. So everybody was pouring their money into securities that were stupid, like toxic. And so the brain isn't the best storytelling tool, but all the elements of the story are in there.
Right.
And I'm actually looking for better storytelling tools, et cetera. I think software is still weirdly, we're quite a few years into the software revolution. It's still not great.
Mm.
It's still really not great. And I'm trying to figure out how do we find our way so that the software helps us make a better civilization.
I love it. Thinking about those things is just so important. And I will put all of those links in the show notes. Jerry, I could talk to you for hours and hours, and I look forward to doing that at some point. But right now, thank you for your time, for your insights, for all of the stuff in both the gray brain and the computer brain. And for sharing that with us.
Love that. Thank you. Thank you for your enthusiasm and your awesome questions. This has been great.
So this is one of those episodes that could have been hours long. There were so many questions I wanted to ask, so many things I wanted to dive deeper into. And I'm sure someday I will. So check the show notes for links for Jerry. Go to jerrysbrain.com and just type stuff in the search bar. It's a very simple interface. But it's fascinating what comes up. You know, again, I put in rethinking and there were 670 something different things that he has rethought over the last 26 years. So fascinating perspective and interesting ideas here. And ultimately, you know, things that we've talked about all along of shrinking the bubble. And we don't have to solve everything. Maybe we just do the best we can in our neighborhood or on our street or just with the people we run into. And practicing trust more often. It's amazing the science that comes into the value of trust and what happens when people are trusted, like that teacher with the kids, the students that he was working with. He was clearly making a giant difference in those kids' lives by trusting them. And unfortunately, he resigned from teaching because he wasn't able to. And you know, I understand both sides. You know, this is why this is all so hard, because there are two sides about trust. And I think we could do it a lot more. So think about it. Visit Jerry's Brain. Thank you for listening, everybody. We've got more great dancing coming up for you next week. Thank you so much for listening. Let me know if there's a topic that you'd like us to dive into, Anne at AnneBonnie.com. Perfectly happy to take suggestions. If there's something that we haven't hit yet that makes you uncomfortable that you'd like to hear about, let us know. Thanks, everybody.